Whispers from the Dark, Season 2, Episode 6. When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Nan Madol, the sunken city built on a forbidden reef, hosted by Raven Vale. There are places on this planet where human logic simply stops working, where every principle of engineering we rely on fails to explain what stands in front of us, where geography itself rebels against construction, fighting human ambition with tides and storms and the relentless erosion of salt water, where survival alone feels improbable, where maintaining basic human life seems like it would require constant struggle, let alone building something permanent, something that endures for centuries, something that defies every rule about what stone should be able to do. Nan Madol is one of those places. And it shouldn't exist at all. Hidden in the western Pacific Ocean, off the eastern shore of the island of Pohnpei in Micronesia, lies a sprawling complex of stone ruins built directly on a coral reef. Not near the reef, using it as a foundation after filling and leveling. Not above the reef on platforms that distribute weight. Not beside the reef where solid ground might provide stability. On it, directly on living coral, on an unstable, shifting, breathing ecosystem that moves with tides and storms and the slow grinding of tectonic plates, nearly 100 artificial islets spread across 11 square miles of shallow lagoon, massive basalt columns, some weighing 50 tons or more, stacked like logs in interlocking formations that somehow hold together despite having no mortar, no cement, no binding agent of any kind. Walls rising from the sea with no visible foundation beneath them. Just stone sitting on coral, sitting on more coral, impossibly balanced, defying every principle of construction. No quarries nearby that could have supplied this much stone. No written records explaining who built it, when they started, how long it took, or why they chose this impossible location. No explanation that fully survives scrutiny when you start asking basic questions about logistics and engineering and the simple physics of moving 50-ton stones across miles of ocean. This city should not exist. The reef should have given way. The storms should have toppled the walls. The tides should have scattered the stones across the ocean floor centuries ago, and yet here it stands, or sits, or waits. Take your pick. For centuries, locals have avoided Nan Madol, not because it is abandoned, empty, safe to ignore, but because it is believed to be awake, still aware, still present, still doing whatever it was built to do, still functioning in ways that have nothing to do with tourism or archaeology or modern understanding. The Pohnpeian people know things about this place that archaeologists are only beginning to acknowledge. They know it should be left alone. That some questions don't need answers. That some stones should never be moved. Tonight, on Whispers from the Dark, we travel to one of the most isolated and unsettling archaeological sites on Earth. A place that makes engineers uncomfortable, that makes historians revise their timelines, that makes everyone who visits it feel like they're standing somewhere they don't belong, somewhere that tolerates human presence but doesn't welcome it. This is the story of Nan Madol, the sunken city built on forbidden ground. The place where stone defied gravity and logic and every reasonable expectation, and where something, long silent but never truly gone, may still remain beneath the water. beneath the stone, beneath the comfortable explanations, we tell ourselves to make the impossible feel manageable. I'm Raven Vale, and you're listening to Whispers from the Dark. Nan Madol is often called the Venice of the Pacific by travel writers who need an easy comparison, but the label fails almost immediately when you examine what you're actually looking at. Venice, for all its architectural wonder, rests on wooden pilings driven into sediment, into mud deposits that have accumulated over millennia, providing a stable, if unconventional, foundation. Venice makes sense once you understand the engineering. Difficult, certainly. Impressive, absolutely. But comprehensible. Nan Madol rests on nothing solid, nothing stable, nothing that should support the weight placed on it. The city is built atop a coral reef that is living, growing, shifting with tides and currents and the slow movement of the earth itself. Coral is not stone. It's not stable. It breaks under pressure. It shifts with storms. It grows and dies and changes shape over time. Building on coral is like building on sand, except sand at least stays where you put it. Coral has a life of its own. The basalt stones used to construct Nan Madol weigh up to 50 tons each. 50 tons. Think about that number. That's the weight of multiple elephants, multiple vehicles, more weight than most modern construction cranes are rated to lift safely. And these stones are stacked without mortar in interlocking formations that somehow, impossibly, hold together. Friction alone. Weight distribution. Precision placement. Some walls rise over 25 feet high, towering structures that should have collapsed under their own weight the moment the coral beneath them shifted even slightly. No cranes existed when this was built. No metal tools beyond the most primitive copper implements that couldn't cut basalt anyway. No wheeled transport because wheels didn't exist in this part of the world. No pulleys, no levers, no mechanical advantage beyond human muscle and rope made from plant fiber and whatever knowledge the builders possessed about moving massive objects across impossible terrain. And absolutely no explanation for how the stones were moved across miles of ocean from their source. Because basalt doesn't occur on Pohnpei's eastern shore, where Nan Madol sits. The nearest known basalt sources are located far inland, across jungles so dense they're nearly impassable even today, across mountains that rise thousands of feet, across waterways that flood seasonally and turn into raging torrents. Transport from those sources would have required moving 50-ton stones through jungle, down mountains, across rivers, and then somehow loading them onto boats or rafts and floating them across open ocean to a reef where they would need to be positioned with millimeter precision. This would be nearly impossible even with modern machinery, with trucks and barges and construction cranes. With stone tools and human labor, it should be completely impossible. And yet the stones are here, carefully placed, aligned with precision that suggests measurement and planning, intentional in every aspect of their arrangement. This was not chaos. This was not trial and error. This was design. This was knowledge. This was understanding of principles we claim these people shouldn't have possessed. Local legends say Nan Madol was built on sacred but forbidden ground. The reef was believed to be unstable not just physically, which is obvious to anyone who understands how coral behaves, but spiritually. Ancient Micronesian lore, passed down through oral tradition for longer than anyone can trace, describes the reef as a threshold between worlds, a place where land, sea, and something unseen overlapped. A thin place, in the way certain cultures describe locations, where the barrier between our world and something else grows permeable. To build there was considered an act of defiance against nature, against the gods, against whatever forces govern the boundary between the known and the unknown. Or perhaps an act of desperation by people who had no choice, who needed to be exactly in this location for reasons that made sense at the time, but have been lost to history. The reef was never meant to hold stone. Everyone who lived there knew this. Everyone understood the danger. Yet someone decided to build anyway. Some stories say the builders were not human at all, that the stones were placed by beings from beneath the sea, by creatures or entities that moved through water, the way we move through air, that understood stone in ways humans never could. Others say the builders were human, but taught by something else, guided by voices from the deep, instructed by entities that communicated in dreams or visions or direct mental contact, given knowledge that didn't come from human experience, but from somewhere older, somewhere beneath the waves, where memory exists differently. Either way, according to every traditional account, the reef was never meant to hold stone. It was never meant to support a city. The fact that it does, that the stones still stand after centuries, suggests either a miracle or knowledge so advanced it appears indistinguishable from the miraculous. According to oral history preserved carefully by Pompeian elders through chains of transmission that stretch back centuries, Nan Madol was the seat of power for the Sodeleur dynasty, rulers who controlled Pompeii for nearly 500 years, half a millennium of uninterrupted rule based in this impossible city built on forbidden ground. Think about that duration. 500 years is longer than the United States has existed. It's longer than most European dynasties lasted. It's continuous, stable power maintained through methods that worked consistently, generation after generation. They were said to rule with absolute authority, not just political power backed by military force or economic control of resources, but something deeper, something more fundamental. They controlled not just what people did, but what people believed was possible. They controlled resources with precision that suggests sophisticated logistics. They controlled movement across the island with thoroughness that required either large numbers of enforcers or something else that made control automatic, that made disobedience unthinkable rather than merely dangerous. They controlled access to knowledge, to techniques, to understanding of how Nan Madol actually functioned, keeping certain information restricted to priesthood or ruling class or whatever structure maintained the city's operations. The oral traditions are clear that they were not merely kings in the traditional sense of hereditary rulers maintaining power through force or tradition or divine right. They were intermediaries, operators, people who stood between the ordinary population living on Pompeii and something else, something beneath the reef, something older than human memory. Something that required regular communication, regular offerings, regular maintenance of whatever relationship kept the arrangement functioning. The legends are remarkably consistent about this basic structure, even though they vary wildly in details. The Sodeleur weren't just ruling. They were maintaining a connection, a relationship, a function that required specific actions performed at specific times in specific ways. They were keeping something appeased, or controlled, or communicated with, or possibly all three, depending on how you interpret accounts that use language we no longer have precise translations for. The stories don't agree on specifics, because the specifics were probably restricted knowledge even when the dynasty functioned, but they agree on the basic structure. There was power here, real power. Not symbolic, not metaphorical, not the psychological power of authority or the social power of control, power that did things, that changed things, that made the impossible routine and the miraculous mundane. People were brought to Nan Madol as tribute, transported from the main island not just to work on construction or to serve the ruling class, but for purposes the stories hint at without stating directly. The oral traditions become vague here, either because the knowledge was lost or because it was never shared widely in the first place. Food was offered to unseen forces, not symbolically but practically. Actual food placed in specific chambers, left in darkness, taken by something, consumed by something. The guards wouldn't enter those spaces. The priests would place offerings and retreat, and the food would be gone later, though whether eaten or dissolved or transported somewhere else, no one living could say. Rituals were conducted in stone chambers that echoed unnaturally, where sound behaved incorrectly according to multiple independent accounts from different time periods, where voices returned altered, where chants produced harmonics that shouldn't exist, where frequencies built up over time until the stone itself vibrated in ways you could feel in your chest, in your bones, in your teeth. The Sodeleur were not just kings maintaining tradition. They were operators, technicians, specialists, people who understood how to use this place for its intended function, how to maintain the systems, how to communicate through whatever interface the city provided, between human consciousness and whatever existed beneath the water. Nan Madol was not built for comfort. This becomes obvious the moment you think about basic human needs. Fresh water is scarce on the reef. There are no springs, no wells, no way to collect rainwater in sufficient quantities. Every drop would need to be brought from the main island. Food production is impossible. No soil for gardens. No space for animals. No way to grow anything or raise anything. The city relies entirely on supply from the mainland, on boats bringing food and water daily, on a supply chain that could be cut at any moment. This was not a place people lived casually, raising families and conducting ordinary life. This was not a residential area in any normal sense. It was a place you were brought to, for specific purposes, for limited durations, or perhaps permanently, but not by choice. Some islets appear residential, with layouts suggesting living spaces, sleeping areas, room for daily activities. Others are clearly ceremonial, with architecture designed for ritual, for gathering, for purposes we can only guess at. Many remain unexplained, spaces that don't fit either category, chambers that serve no obvious function, walls that enclose nothing useful. Certain chambers are sealed in ways that suggest containment rather than shelter. Walls are too thick, openings are too small. Access is deliberately limited. These are not rooms you live in. These are rooms that hold something, or held something, or were built in anticipation of holding something that maybe never came, or maybe did come and is still there, waiting in darkness that electric lights can't fully penetrate. Walls face inward more often than outward, which makes no defensive sense. Defenses face threats. These face the interior of the complex, as if the danger was inside, not outside. Spaces are deliberately restrictive, designed to control movement, to limit options, to funnel people through specific paths, whether they want to or not. Movement through Nan Madol is controlled by architecture that seems to have been designed with crowd control in mind, or crowd direction, or something else that required keeping people moving in specific patterns. Nan Madol feels less like a city built for people to live in, and more like a facility, a complex designed for function rather than comfort, an installation built to do something specific, and housing people was secondary to that primary purpose. The basalt columns used throughout Nan Madol resemble enormous hexagonal logs, naturally formed by volcanic cooling, that creates these perfect geometric shapes when molten rock cools at specific rates under specific conditions. The hexagonal pattern is nature's geometry, the most efficient way to pack circular spaces into flat planes. They're stacked horizontally like timber, crisscrossed in layers that somehow lock together without mortar or binding, each layer supporting the one above through nothing but friction and precise weight distribution. Some weigh more than modern construction cranes are rated to lift safely. 50 tons, 60 tons, possibly 70 tons for the largest examples scattered throughout the complex. Think about moving one of these stones. Think about the logistics. Think about everything that would need to happen for a single stone to travel from source to final position. No ramps have been found that could have moved these stones from the basalt sources to the ocean. No roads lead from the interior volcanic formations to the coast. No ancient highways that show evidence of being built for heavy transport. No evidence exists of rollers or sleds or any method we understand for transporting massive weight across difficult terrain. In other archaeological sites where massive stones were moved, evidence remains. Quarry marks, tool marks, transport routes worn into bedrock, abandoned stones along paths that show the journey from source to destination. Nan Madol has none of this. The stones appear at the site with no clear path explaining how they arrived. Local legends claim the stones were flown into place using sound, using specific chants, using levitation, achieved through techniques that have been lost or suppressed, or never existed in the first place, depending on who you ask and what framework they use to interpret the world. Priests would gather. They would sing specific tones in specific patterns. The stones would rise from the ground as if weightless. They would move through the air like leaves on wind, gliding over jungle canopy, floating across open ocean, settling precisely where they needed to be with the accuracy of modern GPS guidance. This is the story. This is what the oral tradition preserves with remarkable consistency. This is what Pompeian elders will tell you if you ask respectfully, if you listen carefully, if you don't immediately dismiss what they're saying as primitive superstition. Modern archaeologists dismiss this explanation immediately and completely without even considering it seriously. Sound cannot move stone. Physics doesn't allow it. Mass doesn't respond to frequency in ways that would produce levitation or even reduction in effective weight. Acoustic levitation exists in laboratories for microscopic particles under controlled conditions. It doesn't work on 50-ton basalt columns in open air. The idea is impossible according to everything we know about how the universe operates. Except archaeologists who dismiss the traditional explanation cannot replace it with a better answer that actually works. They can't demonstrate how the stones actually moved from volcanic sources miles away to coral reef positioning. They can't replicate the process even with modern machinery. They can't explain the logistics in ways that make sense given the tools available at the time, the population size estimates, the time frames suggested by dating techniques. They say it must have been done with rafts and ropes and human labor over many generations. But when engineers try to model this, when they calculate the forces involved, when they think through the actual mechanics of loading a 50-ton stone onto a raft made from logs lashed together with plant fiber, transporting it across open ocean subject to currents and storms, and then unloading it onto a coral reef without damaging the raft or the reef or losing the stone to the ocean floor, the numbers don't work. The raft that could support 50 tons would be enormous, difficult to maneuver, nearly impossible to control. the coral beneath the final placement site would crush under the weight of stones being dragged or rolled into position. There should be evidence of failure, of stones dropped in transit, of damaged coral indicating trial and error. There isn't. Because gravity doesn't negotiate. Weight is weight, mass is mass, and coral reefs don't support cities built from 50-ton stones stacked 25 feet high without collapsing into rubble. Yet here we are. The city stands. The stones remain precisely where they were placed. And the explanations that should work, that seem reasonable on paper, that follow known principles of ancient engineering, don't actually explain anything when you examine them closely. Excavations at Nan Mardol are rare, limited, and brief. Funding is part of the problem. Access is part of the problem. The remoteness of the site is part of the problem. But there's another factor that archaeologists discuss quietly, unofficially, in conversations that don't make it into published papers. Those who dig at Nan Mardol report intense unease that goes beyond normal fieldwork discomfort. Not just physical discomfort from heat and humidity and insects. Something else? Psychological pressure. A feeling of being watched. A sensation that you're disturbing something that should be left alone. Sudden illness strikes workers with no obvious cause. People who were healthy that morning suddenly can't continue. Disorientation sets in without warning. Experienced archaeologists who can normally work underground, in confined spaces, in uncomfortable conditions, suddenly feel claustrophobic in areas that are actually quite open. A pressure-like sensation in the chest that makes breathing difficult, even though oxygen levels are normal. Equipment malfunctions more frequently than it should. Film gets ruined. Digital cameras fail. Recording devices stop working. Early European explorers who visited Nan Mardol in the 19th century described it as oppressive. Not just physically difficult. Oppressive. Mentally exhausting. Several written accounts mention refusing to stay overnight, choosing to camp on the main island and return by boat rather than sleep among the ruins. Some couldn't articulate why. They just knew they needed to leave before dark, that staying after sunset would be dangerous in ways they couldn't define. Local guides still avoid certain islets, not because they're structurally unsound, not because they're difficult to access. They avoid them because the places feel wrong, because tradition says these spaces should not be entered. Because people who enter without proper respect, without proper preparation, without proper reason, fall ill, or experience visions, or return changed. Not everyone, not every time, but often enough that the warnings persist, often enough that guides refuse to go there, regardless of how much money you offer. They say the city is not empty. It is merely quiet. There's a difference. Empty means nothing is there. Quiet means something is there, but choosing not to make noise, choosing to observe, choosing to wait. One of Nan Mardol's most infamous locations is Nandawas, the so-called Isle of the Dead. The name itself is a warning, a designation that has persisted across centuries because everyone who learns about this place understands immediately that certain areas deserve special caution. High walls surround a central tomb complex believed to house Sodalur rulers, and whatever priests or shamans or operators maintained the city's function during its active period. The walls here are massive, taller and thicker than anywhere else in Nan Mardol, built from stones so large and so carefully placed that they create an enclosure that feels less like architecture and more like fortification. Not protection from outside threats. Protection of the outside from what's contained within. Entering the complex feels like entering a fortress or a prison, and visitors consistently report the same sensation of oppression, of heaviness, of atmosphere that makes breathing difficult even though oxygen levels are normal. The tombs themselves are massive structures, far larger than simple burial chambers would need to be. They're sealed with stones that would require machinery to move, positioned with such precision that gaps between stones are minimal despite the absence of mortar. These are largely unexplored, not just because of technical difficulties or funding limitations, but because local tradition forbids it absolutely. Because Pohnpeian people refuse to guide anyone there. Because archaeologists who have tried to investigate report experiences that make them reluctant to return. The resistance isn't just cultural sensitivity or respect for indigenous beliefs. It's something more visceral. People who enter Nandawas without permission, without proper preparation, without understanding what they're dealing with, report consistent effects. Not everyone. Not every time. But often enough that patterns emerge, that warnings prove accurate, that dismissing the stories as superstition becomes harder with each documented case. Local belief holds that spirits guard the site. Not metaphorically, not in the sense of memory or cultural respect, or the psychological weight of sacred space weighing on visitors who know the location's significance. Physically, entities that exist in some form, that respond to intrusion, that protect the tombs from those who lack authority to enter. Whether you interpret these spirits as psychological projection, as remaining consciousness from the buried, as thought forms created by centuries of belief, or as actual independent entities depends entirely on your framework for understanding reality. But the effects people report are consistent regardless of interpretation. Those who enter without permission are said to fall ill within days, sometimes within hours. Fevers with no identifiable bacterial or viral cause, confusion that persists beyond what dehydration or heat exhaustion would explain. Injuries that happen for no apparent reason. People stumbling on flat ground, cutting themselves on stones that weren't sharp, suffering accidents that experienced field workers should easily avoid. And some, according to stories that persist despite skepticism from outsiders who weren't there, never return. Boats found empty, drifting near Nandawas with no signs of struggle, no indication where the occupants went. Camps abandoned with supplies still in place, as if people simply walked away and kept walking into the ocean. People who went to Nandawas for legitimate archaeological research or simply tourism curiosity, and simply weren't there when others came looking hours later. Over time, inevitably, the sea has begun reclaiming Nan Madol. Saltwater is corrosive. It erodes stone, slowly but inevitably. Vegetation grows in cracks, roots forcing apart stones that have stood together for centuries. Tides flood chambers that were once above water level. Sea level rise, whether from climate change or tectonic settling or both, brings water higher into the complex with each passing decade. Yet the city endures, slower to fall than it should be, more resistant to entropy than makes sense, given the conditions. And the more it sinks, the more it floods, the more vegetation claims the walls, the more it seems like this was always meant to happen. Like Nan Madol was never built to last forever. Like it was always temporary in ways that span centuries but not millennia. Some researchers, the ones willing to say unusual things publicly, believe Nan Madol was never meant to last forever. It was meant to function for a specific period, fulfill a specific purpose, and then disappear back into the ocean from which it emerged, return to the threshold it was built upon, become part of the boundary again, rather than remaining as evidence of whatever happened here. Nan Madol is not alone in its impossibility. This is important. This is something most discussions of the site fail to emphasize. Across the world, separated by thousands of miles of ocean, by continental barriers, by cultures that had no contact with each other, according to conventional history, similar megalithic sites exist. Structures built in ways that make no sense according to what we know about available technology. From stones too large to move with human labor alone, in locations that defy logic, that challenge every practical consideration of where civilizations should build. The Yonaguni Monument beneath the sea near Japan, carved stone structures that may be natural formations or may be the oldest building on Earth, depending on whose interpretation you accept, whose analysis you trust, which academic faction you align with. Dwarka, submerged off the coast of India, legendary city of Krishna that archaeology has confirmed actually exists underwater, that sonar has mapped, that divers have photographed, that nobody knows quite how to explain within comfortable timelines. Bimini Road in the Bahamas, stones arranged too perfectly to be natural, too weathered to be recent construction, too controversial to discuss in mainstream archaeology without triggering argument. All coastal locations where land meets ocean, all massive in scale, built from stones weighing tons rather than pounds. All unexplained by mainstream archaeology in ways that satisfy basic questions about methods and purposes. All built by cultures we're told didn't have the knowledge or technology or organizational capacity to build them. These were not primitive societies experimenting randomly, throwing stones together, hoping something would stand. They were builders with knowledge we no longer possess. They were engineers who understood principles we've forgotten or never knew. They were connected to something, some source of information, some tradition of building that existed globally and then vanished, leaving only these impossible structures as evidence. Nan Madol does not make sense as a capital city. Capitals are built for accessibility, for commerce, for defense, for all the practical reasons humans gather in specific locations. Nan Madol makes sense as a boundary, a place built where land ends and ocean begins, a liminal space, a threshold between states of existence. Some believe it was a ceremonial center where rituals were performed to ensure prosperity, to guarantee rain, to maintain cosmic order. Others believe it was a power amplifier, something that took ritual or political or esoteric power and intensified it, broadcast it, made it effective across greater distances than should be possible. But one theory refuses to go away, despite academic resistance, despite lack of direct evidence, despite how uncomfortable it makes people. The theory that Nan Madol was built to interact with something beneath the water, something older than the reef, something that existed before humans arrived on Pohnpei, possibly before humans existed as a species, something that required interface, required communication, required regular contact maintained by specialists who understood how to operate the city as a system, rather than just inhabit it as a space. Micronesian legends speak of beings that lived beneath the sea long before humans arrived, not gods in the sense of omnipotent creators, not monsters in the sense of mindless threats, something in between, entities that existed in the ocean, that were part of the ocean, that could interact with humans if the circumstances were right, but usually didn't because the circumstances usually weren't right. Nan Madol was said to be a place where offerings were made not upward toward sky gods or abstract forces, but downward, into the water, into the reef, into whatever spaces exist beneath the coral where light doesn't reach and human understanding breaks down. And where the ocean was not an enemy to be fought, not an obstacle to overcome, but an audience. Something that watched, something that listened, something that responded when the right rituals were performed, the right sounds were made, the right stones were placed in the right configurations. According to legend preserved across multiple oral traditions, the Sodaleur dynasty fell when a warrior named Isokelekel arrived from the sea. Some stories say he was human, a great warrior from another island who united opposition to Sodaleur tyranny. Others say he was not human at all, that he came from beneath the waves, that he was sent by the forces the Sodaleur had been communicating with, sent to end a relationship that had gone wrong, to terminate an agreement that had been violated. He overthrew the rulers of Nan Madol. The battle, if there was a battle, is not described in detail. The legends skip from arrival to victory without explaining the mechanics. Afterward, the city was abandoned, not destroyed, not torn down, not dismantled stone by stone, just left, walked away from, surrendered to the ocean and the vegetation and time, as if no one wanted to remain once the connection was severed, as if living there without the relationship that justified its existence was pointless or dangerous, as if the city had served its purpose or failed to serve its purpose, and either way there was no point in staying. Today, Nan Madol is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, officially protected, officially valued, officially recognized as significant. But few visit. The remoteness helps. Pompeii itself is difficult to reach, requiring multiple flights and significant expense. Nan Madol requires boats and guides and timing with tides. But even accounting for practical difficulties, visitor numbers are low. Fewer stay overnight on Pompeii than you'd expect for a World Heritage Site. Fewer extend their visits. Most people see Nan Madol and leave quickly. The atmosphere is heavy in ways that cameras don't capture. The silence is unnatural, not peaceful, not empty. Pregnant with expectation. The air feels thick, harder to breathe than humidity alone would explain. It feels like a place waiting for something that never returned, or waiting for something that hasn't finished leaving, or waiting for the right moment to activate again, to resume whatever function it was built to perform, to reconnect with whatever it was built to interface with. Nan Madol defies explanation, because it was never meant to be understood casually. It wasn't built with future tourists in mind, with academics in mind, with anyone except the people who built it, and whatever they were building it for. It was built on forbidden ground that everyone knew was forbidden, with impossible stone that everyone knew couldn't be moved. For reasons that feel deliberately obscured, hidden not through time's passage, but through intentional suppression, through knowledge that was restricted even when the city functioned. It stands where it shouldn't, on coral that shouldn't support it, in a location that makes no practical sense. It endures when it should sink, when storms should have scattered the stones centuries ago, when the ocean should have claimed it completely by now. And it waits in silence, while the ocean slowly takes it back, grain by grain, stone by stone, returning it to the threshold it was built upon. Perhaps Nan Madol was not a city in any sense we understand cities. Perhaps it was a message, a marker, a warning, or an invitation, or a boundary stone, a reminder that once, long ago, humans built in ways we no longer remember, with knowledge we've lost, for purposes we can't reconstruct. Or perhaps humans were helped by something we no longer acknowledge, something that taught us, or guided us, or simply used us to build what it needed built, and when the relationship ended, the knowledge left with it. I'm Raven Vale, and this has been Whispers from the Dark, Season 2, Episode 6. Some cities are lost to time, buried under sand or reclaimed by jungle, their stories scattered and fragmented. Others are hidden differently, not lost, concealed, waiting beneath the surface of the ocean until the tide decides it's time to remember them. Until sea level changes enough to reveal what was always there. Until someone asks the right questions, or makes the right sounds, or stands in the right place. The stones remember. The coral remembers. And somewhere beneath the surface, beneath the threshold, something is still listening to see if humans remember too.